Just welcome everybody to Dhammaloka again. And my name is Venerable Nisaranos, for those who don't know. And I ordained at the monastery at Serpentine, Bodhinyana, and lived there for 9.5 years. But now I'm living in Sri Lanka. I've been living there since 2006, on and off, as it were. And this afternoon we have a sutta class, so really good. Thank you. That's great.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. And this week, I don't know what you've been studying recently. Actually, I was going to look up on the website to see what you've been doing, but I didn't have time. So today, I was thinking to study for us to read and go through the Nandika Owada Sutta, Sutta 146. Have you done that recently, or have you been through that recently? No, doesn't ring a bell. Oh, that's good. Oh, right, that's very good. That's good. Yeah, that's why I'm going to do it. That's because yesterday was the Upasita, the full moon day, and you probably know on the full moon day the monks and nuns gather together and they in their separate monasteries and recite the rules. And for being a monk, for being a nun, for being a bhikkhuni. And yesterday was the full moon day in Sri Lanka that they remember that the Venerable Sanghamitta, a bhikkhuni from India, came to Sri Lanka about 242 BC, and she brought a cutting of the Bodhi tree with her. And in December, the full moon in December in Sri Lanka, they always remember that she came to Sri Lanka with the Bodhi tree. And that Bodhi tree was planted in Anuradhapura, the capital, and is still there today. It's rather old looking. You know, there's one branch, as it were, leaning and propped up by various props, gold props, actually. And but it's still there today. And the Venerable Sanghamitta, she was the sister of the founder, as it were, of Buddhism in Sri Lanka. They call him the Arahant Mahinda. They never say Venerable Mahinda, they always say Arahant Mahinda. And he came to Sri Lanka the year before, in I think 243, and established Buddhism in Sri Lanka because he encountered the king who was on a hunting trip. And it's a really unusual story, actually. It's quite interesting. And he didn't immediately start teaching the king about the Dhamma, about the Buddha's teachings. He gave the king, he questioned him. He gave him a set of questions to see if he was up to it, which I thought was very unusual. So he had these questions. I don't remember the questions now, but they were really interesting questions. And the king answered them correctly, showing that he was a person of intelligence and discernment. And then the Arahant Mahinda taught him. And he converted, and so did the whole of his court. Convert at that time, and the whole country, as it were, became Buddhist overnight. But I have a suspicion, and scholars say this, that actually Buddhism had probably been coming to Sri Lanka because it was originally had strong connections with India, probably in dribs and drabs from the time of the Buddha, actually. So probably some knowledge of the teachings was there, but this was the actual official date that conversion happened and the whole island became Buddhist. They remember that as the full moon in June, Poson Poya. But not only is the December full moon remembered for Venerable Sanghamitta bringing the Bodhi tree to Sri Lanka, it's also remembered for the fact that she ordained 500 women. Presumably not immediately as bhikkhunis. I think they'd have to be samaneris, like novice nuns, first, on the full moon in December. So whether it was soon after she arrived, I'm not sure. One of them, the leading one, was Queen Anula. She was one of the queens, probably one of the queens of the king, and she became became a nun and then became a bhikkhuni. And bhikkhunis were in Sri Lanka until 1100 and something, when there was a very bad famine, and then they died out in Sri Lanka. But about 400 AD, some Sri Lankan bhikkhunis went to China and ordained Buddhist nuns in China. They became bhikkhunis, kept the lineage going, and hence we can the bhikkhuni ordination has been started again via that connection with China, Taiwan, Korea. So good. So this is why this one is a teaching, as Lynn was saying, a teaching to the bhikkhunis. And I don't know if there are many in the Nikayas, in the Buddha's teachings, but this one stands out. And also the Buddha said that Venerable Nandika, who's the main, is the teacher in the sutta, not the Buddha, Venerable Nandika, is the Buddha said was the foremost in instructing bhikkhunis. So he got I think they say, because of this teaching that he gave, because all of the nuns, all the bhikkhunis that listened to it, achieved some stage of enlightenment, you know, so that's pretty impressive. So as we go along, we can discuss it. But I'm always interested in why the Buddha didn't do it. You know, he could do it. Why did he ask Venerable Nandika to do it? It was his turn to do it, but give teachings. But it's interesting, yeah. So we can start with the sutta. And as we go along, if you've got any questions, please, we'll talk about that. Talk about it as it comes up. Because if you wait after a while, I don't know about you, but the question goes. You've moved on. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Savatthi, in Jetta's grove, Anathapindika's park. Then Mahaprajapati, go to me, together with 500 bhikkhunis, went to the Blessed One. Does everybody know who Mahaprajapati Gotami is? Do you know who she is? Yeah, that's right. The Buddha's, the Bodhisattva's stepmother, because when the Bodhisattva, 146, page, sorry, 1120, 146, 1120, there we are. Yes, because when the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, was born, his mother, Mahamaya Devi, she gave birth to him at Lumbini, and then within a week had died. And so then the Buddha's, her sister, Mahaprajapati, was also married to the king, because the king's at that time not monogamous, and so she raised the Bodhisattva. She raised the Buddha to be like her own child. So very, very close connection, you know. When did she become a bhikkhuni? That's, interesting. Exactly when it occurred, I'm not sure. I think sometimes they say maybe the fifth vassa, 5 years after the Buddha's enlightenment. I'm not quite sure of the actual length of time. When the Buddha visited his hometown, Kapilavastu, and she made a request with other women to be ordained, become bhikkhunis, become nuns, and the Buddha actually said no. He didn't agree to it, and he had no doubt his reasons for it. And then the Buddha left Kapilavastu and travelled further south, and went to a city, I think it was in Vesali he was, which is quite a long way south, and he was there, and his stepmother, Mahaprajapati Gotami, and these 500 women, usually 500 means a lot, big group, came. They had already shaved their heads, wearing robes, and they were barefoot, and they were walking, they were really tired, exhausted, and they came to ask the Buddha again for, you know, full ordination to allow women to go forth, to live the life just like a monk would live. And so they came there, you know, and the Buddha refused again, actually. And so after that refusal, they met Venerable Ananda, who is the Buddha's attendant, like a, what do you say, personal assistant these days, attendant, and he they asked him for his help to intercede with the Buddha. And so he went to the Buddha and said to the Buddha, are women, and they talked about the ordination of ordaining women as like monks, and he asked, are women capable of enlightenment just the same as men? And he said, yes, they are. Of course they are. There's no problem with that. And so then Venerable Ananda said, in that case, Bhante, will you ordain women as nuns, as bhikkhunis? And he said he agreed to it then. He agreed to it. And there's many, many people, you know, they ask why did he, you know, originally not agree to it, was against it. And I think there are lots of people that have different ideas of why the Buddha refused. At that time, too, you know, the position of women and not far from equal, so, and also quite dangerous for them in living on their own in isolated places. So there may have been many reasons why he didn't agree at that stage, but he did eventually. And of course, you see in the suttas, you know, he often talks about the four assemblies. And it's always the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen. So it was there, definitely something that was very much part of the plan, as it were, for the sangha. You know, and it's important too, because if half the sangha is missing, it's yes. So so this is the Buddha's stepmother with these 500 bhikkhunis. This sutta may in fact actually be not long after, maybe a year or two after they received the higher ordination. So it could be. So it continues, after paying homage to the Blessed One, she stood at one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One advise the bhikkhunis, let the Blessed One instruct the bhikkhunis, let the Blessed One give the bhikkhunis a talk on the Dhamma. And this request actually is for instruction. It was part of the bhikkhuni's rules when the Buddha agreed to ordain women as bhikkhunis. He laid down eight conditions, and one of them was that they must receive an instruction every fortnight, you know, when they have their rules, when they recite their rules, and they must have some instruction which focused on those first eight rules to begin with, but could go on to be a Dhamma talk. So every fortnight they would have a teaching from one of the monks, one of the senior monks. And yes, these rules are called the Garo Dhammas, and they're controversial today because many people don't like them. Say that they're not the word of the Buddha, that they're a later addition. And some of the, you know, scholars who say this, they say it, they have their reasons for it. But it's in the suttas and in the Vinaya, it's in many places. They talk about these Garo Dhammas. So I can't quite see that that they're not from the Buddha, actually. It doesn't strike me as strange, actually, that, you know, he would lay down these rules, these conditions, prior to establishing the bhikkhuni order, because the position of women in that time, I think, was such that he had to, I think, make it set some limits and establish the relationship between the monks and the nuns, you know, in a way that would be acceptable at that time and would also mean that they could practice well, but not too closely together. I think that's the idea. Because they live separately, you know. So it's an interesting thing. Here at the Nuns Monastery, I'm very pleased to see they still keep the Garo Dhammas, they still observe those, because they're traditional, and it's good to keep, actually, I think. You know.
I can go through some of them. The first Garodhamma is that, and this is the one that many nuns don't like, that a bhikkhuni, no matter how senior she is, should pay respects to a bhikkhu, should bow to a bhikkhu, even if he's just ordained that day and she's been a nun for 50 years. This is very hard, very hard. And one of the other rules is that they must have a teaching every fortnight from a monk. And I can't remember all the other ones. There's another six go with it. But those Garodhammas are not popular, especially that first one, you know, because these days we like to see equality, don't we, you know. And it seems unfair if a nun has been practicing for many years, she should bow to a monk who has just ordained. But by and large, you know, the two communities live separately, so it's not like not such a big issue, I wouldn't think, for me. Yes, that's a good point. Some of them are in the bhikkhuni vinaya, and some aren't. You know, some aren't. That's quite right. Yes, and yes, it's a whole area of discussion, controversy. Yes, yes. Oh, that's quite good actually to keep them. Yeah, I know. Yes. Well, that's good, because I think they... Oh, yeah. Are these Dhammagupta nuns? Nuns in the Dhammagupta tradition? Because they... Yeah, they keep the... Ah. Yeah. Train. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, it probably, yes, there's one very strict... group, Dhammagupta, and they keep the vinaya and the rules quite very well, actually. Yes, that's good. But if you want to read or find out more about the Garodhammas, I think there would be information in some of the books in the library, particularly the Buddhist Monastic Code by Ajahn Tanisaro. When he's talking in the index, you can look up bhikkhunis, and it'll have, I think it actually says Garodhammas. And you can read the eight conditions that the Buddha laid down. Yes, yes. It's interesting, because there are many technical signs to it that. Even in the monk's vinaya, a monk can still ordain a woman as a nun, as a samanera to begin with. Usually they go samanera, sikumana, and then they become a bhikkhuni, so they have a gradual career path. But a monk can do that. They never abolished that. In these days, later, they had a good situation where the bhikkhunis would do the first ordination, and then they could ask some personal questions of the candidate, you know, which not so appropriate for monks to ask. And then the candidate would come to the bhikkhu sangha, to the monks, and that ordination would be approved, you know, just... and so it had two ordinations, as it were. But the Buddha never got rid of, never cancelled the possibility that a monk could just ordain women as samaneris, and then they could become bhikkhunis later. Yeah, never. So, now on that occasion, the elder bhikkhus were taking turns in advising the bhikkhunis, but the venerable Nandika did not want to advise them when his turn came. And then if you read the footnote there, it explains... 11. Uh-huh. Yeah, it mentions these Garodhammas, one of the eight important rules laid down by the Buddha when he established the Bhikkhuni Sangha, stipulated that every fortnight the Bhikkhuni should request the bhikkhus to send a bhikkhu for the purpose of giving them an exhortation. That's like an instruction. Exhortation sounds like really, I don't know. It always has that sound of, you know, you're really laying it on the line or something. According to the MA, this is a commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya, in a previous life, Venerable Nandika had been a king, and those bhikkhunis, the 500, had been his concubines, so like his wives. And he wanted to avoid his turn in advising the bhikkhunis because he thought that another bhikkhu possessing the knowledge of past lives, seeing him giving an exhortation surrounded by the bhikkhunis, would think that he was still not separate, could not separate himself from his former concubines, who were still attached to them. But the Buddha saw that that Nandika's discourse to the bhikkhunis would benefit them, and thus he requested them to instruct them. Bhikkhu Bodhi, if you listen to Bhikkhu Bodhi's talks on the Majjhima Nikaya, he says that he finds that one hard to believe. I mean, maybe I think there must have been some former link between them, because, you know, I think, well, why did the Buddha ask him? Why didn't he, you know, he could have instructed them himself, and then they would have attained enlightenment. But he asked not, you could say it was his turn, Nandika's turn, but I wonder whether there was some connection between them. Maybe they weren't his concubines, but he knew them from a past life. Because he seemed to have, there seemed to be a connection that allowed them to become enlightened quite quickly. So there may be something in it, if it's not exactly like they say in the commentary. It's always a bit colourful. Well, it says here that that he I don't know if he'd been doing it before. He could have been doing it before and then had decided he didn't want to do it anymore, or it could have just been that it was the first time and you know, he didn't want to start. And there might be many reasons why he didn't want to, you know. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, whose turn is it to advise the bhikkhunis? Venerable Sir, it is Venerable Nandika's turn to advise the bhikkhunis, but he does not want to advise them, even though it is his turn. This is very interesting. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Nandika, obviously he was summoned. Advise the bhikkhunis, Nandika. Instruct the bhikkhunis, Nandika. Give the bhikkhunis a talk on the Dhamma, Brahmin. So he's very direct, isn't he? You know, he's not just saying, would you please? He's saying, do it. So the Buddha obviously knew that this would benefit them a lot, so it was very worthwhile. This is interesting because if when you read the suttas and you read the Vinaya, you know, you really get a feeling for the qualities of the Buddha, that he could be quite strong and direct. Some of the things he said really strong and quite direct, but obviously a lot of the time very compassionate and kind and caring. And, of course, we don't know the tone that he said some of those very strong things in, because tone is all important, isn't it? You know, sometimes you can say quite strong things in a very nice way, but if you read them, you think, my goodness, how could they say that? So I think he was being very firm with him that, you know, he should do his duty. So. And then it continues, yes, Venerable, so he didn't even argue. The Venerable Nandika replied. Then in the morning, the Venerable Nandika dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Savatthi for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Savatthi and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went with a companion to the Rajaka Park. The Rajaka Park was probably in the city, I think. So Savatthi is not that far. I mean, the Jetavana, where the Buddha was staying, is not that far from the city of Savatthi. But the nuns, the bhikkhunis, they had to live in cities, had to live in urban areas. I don't know when it exactly happened, but one of the bhikkhunis, Uplavana, she was living in the forest, like the monks did, and she was raped. And so after that, the Buddha said to King Pasenadi, you know, that the nuns should live in the city, they should have protection, so that this didn't happen. And so then the nuns' monasteries were always in the cities. So we're lucky here because we have a nuns' monastery in the forest, which is very nice. It's good. Because it always seems a bit unfair because, you know, when you practice in the forest like I am in Sri Lanka,
it's quite special, you know, because you're on your own and you can see the mind very well, your own mind. You can observe nature, learn from nature. And so it's a really ideal setting, isn't it, for, you know, developing meditation, deep meditation and insight wisdom. I mean, it's where the Buddha became enlightened, in nature, you know. So, yes. But our nuns are very lucky. They've got a very nice monastery. The bhikkhuni saw the Venerable Nandaka coming in the distance and prepared a seat and set out water for the feet. The Venerable Nandaka sat down on the seat, made ready, and washed his feet. The bhikkhunis paid homage to him and he sat down at one side. When they were seated, the Venerable Nandaka told the bhikkhunis, "Sisters, this talk will be in the form of questions. When you understand, you should say, 'We understand.' When you do not understand, you should say, 'We do not understand.' When you are doubtful or perplexed, you should ask me, 'How is this, Venerable Sir? What is the meaning of this?' Venerable Sir, we are satisfied and pleased with the Master Nandaka for inviting us in this way." So the bhikkhuni is already happy that he was going to have a dialogue, basically, with them. And so they're very happy at that sort of direct teaching. And you see in many of the Buddha's discourses are like that, aren't they? They're like question and answer. And even though the questions, often the same questions, they seem to have been very effective, you know, for obviously asked at the right time and maybe in the right way, and then it was possible for these for the people listening to become enlightened. And so then we continue. "Sisters, what do you think? Is the I permanent or impermanent?" And they replied, "Impermanent, Venerable Sir." "Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness?" "Suffering, Venerable Sir." "Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself." "No, Venerable Sir." So this is important teaching, isn't it, on impermanence. The fact that the I and all the whole body, of course, is impermanent, doesn't last, wears out, and is subject to subject to suffering due to illness, due to weather, due to aging. We have suffering of the body. And it's subject to change. It's always changing. And yes. Food. Yeah, food is the ahara, the nutriment for the body, for sure. You know, because if we do not have food, then the body will immediately, you know, well, first great deal of suffering and then perish, then we die. Yeah, so it is the nutriment for the body. That's important, yes. Any other comments or questions people have about the impermanence of the eye? So we can continue. Because it is impermanent, of course, it's difficult to take something. Well, I don't think very many people think of the I being themselves, but they think it's mine. Because we use that, don't we, in conventional speech. We'll say, "This is my eyes." But as I say to people, you know, we say that, of course, but we're not running the eyes. We're not organising the eye functioning, are we? You know, that... The fact that the light can come to the retina and we can get this image on the back of the eyeball and then that can be transmitted to the brain. I don't know about many of you, but I have very little to do with that process, actually. It happens. You know, you can see already it's really an impermanent, a permanent function, situation, actually, yes. Yes. Mm.
Yes, in the sense of yes, in the sense that we can see, and we a lot of our experience is based on seeing, actually, and a lot of our beliefs too, actually, based on seeing, because we say, you know, seeing is believing. So what does a blind person do? And so, you know, often we will see things, and then we come to a view that we think is right. And I'm always interested when I find that, you know, that, you know, like you see things, you might see somebody in the distance and say, oh, I think, oh, it's so-and-so. And they come close and you, oh, not at all. It's not them at all. So, you know, often our seeing, our perception is inaccurate, you know, it's not complete. But yes, we think I am seeing. Mm. So, and then it continues, sisters, what do you think? Is the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And they reply, no, Venerable Sir. Why is that? Because, Venerable Sir, we have already seen this well, as it actually is, with proper wisdom. Thus, these six internal bases are impermanent. So the sense organs are impermanent. And the footnote for that... Yes, it says that they've seen it with the wisdom of insight. So they have developed some wisdom, some insight, probably based on meditation, but haven't necessarily reached a stage of enlightenment, you know, not necessarily enlightened. But that is some, that's quite an important one to see. And then Nandika, Venerable Nandika says, good, good, sisters. So it is with a noble disciple who sees this as it actually is with proper wisdom. So he's talked about the internal sense bases, and now he'll talk about the external sense bases. And this always seems, you know, it might seem, to many people, might seem very dry, but actually it's really interesting. I can remember my first teacher here, Ajahn Jaggero. He talked about the sense bases quite a lot. The first teaching I think I had for him was about sense bases. And, you know, teaching like the Buddha did, that this is our world, you know, the world we live in, of the five senses and the mind, you know, and the objects that the senses engage with, that the mind engages with. This is the whole of the world. And it really it floored me when I thought that, yes, that's all there is, actually. You know, this is what, how we know, this is the world that we live in, actually. And so it's quite, it's a really interesting teaching to take to heart. And obviously one of the areas that we can be, the food, the nutriment for becoming enlightened, you know. Because we can really see, can't we? This is where craving arises, where desire arises, when we see something that we like, we hear something we like, smell, taste, touch, or think about something we like, and craving arises, either to get it or maybe to even get rid of it. So, good. And now we go, good. Sisters, what do you think? Are forms, sounds, odours, flavours, tangibles, touches, mind objects permanent or impermanent? So these are all the external objects that we contact through our sense organs. And they reply, impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Sometimes people will say, two for dukkha, won't they? Unsatisfactoriness. Too, because it takes in that shade of meaning as well, because it can never be totally satisfied through any of the senses, you know. And that's why with the sense contacts you usually need more and more, don't you, intensity for to experience more pleasure. And then he says, suffering, Venerable Sir, is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And they reply, no, Venerable Sir, Why is that? Because, Venerable Sir, we have already seen this well as it actually is, with proper wisdom thus. These six external bases are impermanent. So all those things outside of us are impermanent as well. The body impermanent and the sense organs that are housed in the body and all the world that we see, hear, smell, taste and touch, that too is impermanent. And sometimes you hear more like an Abhidhamma presentation, don't you, that it's changing moment by moment, which is actually the reality. We don't see it. The body's changing moment by moment, and all these external phenomena, they're changing moment by moment too. You know, usually breaking down. Slowly, slowly. Sometimes fast. And so he says, good, good sisters, so it is with a noble disciple who sees it as it actually is with proper wisdom. Sisters, what do you think? Is eye consciousness or ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, taste, body consciousness, mind consciousness, permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. And then he says, is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent, suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And they reply, no, Venerable Sir. Why is that? Because, Venerable Sir, we have already seen this well as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. These six classes of consciousness are impermanent. So we have all the six classes of consciousness that create the coming together of the sense organs, the objects of the sense organs, and the consciousness, the appropriate consciousness. Then we can have contact, can't we? Then we can see, we can hear, we can smell and taste and touch. So we need all those three components to actually have contact, to be aware of things. And sometimes the eye is working well, but we may not be paying attention to, there may be somebody there, we may not even see them actually, may not have a sense object of sight. So then there is no contact, then the process is not complete. So we need the internal organ, we need the external phenomena, and then we need the consciousness, the particular aspect of consciousness that will engage the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body and the mind to actually experience it. And then we have contact, and then from contact we can have feeling, can't we? We can either find that pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This ties in with, you probably know, dependent origination, Paticca Sammuppada, that we have the six sense bases, and from that we have contact, from that we have Vedana, feeling. From that, once we have a feeling, then craving can come up in an unenlightened person. Yeah, consciousness, yeah.
That, to me, is like knowing.
Knowing, yeah, it is a quality of knowing, yes, that's right, yeah, yes. It is a quality of knowing, but it's usually, the way the Buddha teaches, is like it's divided into these six categories. So it's a consciousness particular to visual phenomena, the sounds, smells, tastes, touches and so on, and the mind itself. So it is a knowing, yeah, it has to be a knowing. Otherwise, if there's no knowing, then we will not be aware. We won't have contact, yeah, exactly. So we have that whole process, and now he continues the teaching. So he says, good, good sisters, so it is with a noble disciple who sees this as it actually is with proper wisdom. And then he gives a very nice simile. He says to them, sisters, suppose an oil lamp is burning. Its oil is impermanent and subject to change. Its wick is impermanent and subject to change. The flame is impermanent and subject to change. And its radiance is impermanent and subject to change. radiance, like I think the light coming out from the flame. Now, would anyone be speaking rightly who spoke thus? While this oil lamp is burning, its oil, wick, and flame are impermanent and subject to change, but its radiance is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. So that's a very nice simile, which he explains in a minute. And they reply, "No, Venerable Sir, why is this? Because, Venerable Sir, while that oil lamp is burning, its oil, wick, flame, and flame are impermanent and subject to change. So its radiance must be impermanent and subject to change." So I think everybody probably reading that, listening to that simile, immediately they'd have the same reaction, that the same response, isn't it, naturally? Something that is impermanent, how can something that depends on something be, that is impermanent, be permanent? Not possible. But I imagine this is very much like, you know, the body is impermanent, but the soul, eternal, you know. But he develops this, so he explains it in a different way. He says, "So too, sisters, would anyone be speaking rightly who spoke thus? These six internal bases, the sense organs, are impermanent and subject to change. But the pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling, that's like neutral feeling, that one experience is dependent, independence upon the six internal bases, is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change." So he is pointing out that the six sense organs that we have for experiencing the world, if they are impermanent, and hence the when if they are impermanent, how can the feelings that arise from contact with the world outside, how can those feelings be permanent? You know, the feeling, whether pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or neutral feeling. And that's important because often feeling is sort of like the place, the hiding place for this idea of self, isn't it? You know, we often identify very much with the feelings, and so this is like an important area to investigate, you know, and with reason, and then with the help of meditation to go even deeper, you know, in experience, actual experience. So now he, and they reply, of course, "No, Venerable Sir, why is this? Because each feeling," this is an important one, "each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition. And with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases." So the feelings that arise from having an eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind, feelings that arise dependent on that, are dependent on conditions that support those organs and support the arising of feelings. And in the note, it will explain that. It explains very much the same thing, that the coming together of eye forms and eye consciousness is eye contact, like I was just talking about. And this is the primary condition for the arising of feeling born of eye contact. So in other words, if we were blind, we would not have eye consciousness. We would not have feeling arising from seeing this and that. You know, it wouldn't be unpleasant, wouldn't be pleasant, wouldn't be neutral, because we couldn't see it. Couldn't see it. And with the cessation of the eye, one of the factors responsible for eye contact is removed. Thus, eye contact ceases with its cessation. The feeling born of eye contact also ceases. So if the eye, for whatever reason, is not operating, or we're looking away, then the feeling that arises due to what we'd seen before finishes. It will finish. Of course, I think the way this often works is that we have it in memory, in mind, that we can bring it back when we think about it. But the actual experience is finished, you know, and that feeling has gone. So it's important in the Buddha's teaching to see the conditions that support things. Because once we see the process of conditions, then it's not possible to take it as something as me, mine, or a self, myself. Not possible, because we've seen it's arising due to these conditions. It's not some self in here that's running the show. Because this is what many people will feel, will experience in a way, that there's some self inside. But once we see that it arises due to conditions, that it's no longer possible to maintain that, intellectually at least. Because in a feeling level, at a deeper level, we of course hang on to that. And it's not until one becomes a sotapanna that one has managed to reduce that and has seen through view that, you know, that this is not a self, that it is due to conditions. And a sotapanna will see dependent origination and the conditionality that's supporting the arising of future lives, this life and future lives, the process that's going on here and now, and the process that leads to future lives. So he says to them, he must have been very impressed, I think, good, sisters, so it is with a noble disciple who sees this as it actually is with proper wisdom. And then he gives another simile. Sisters, suppose a great tree is standing possessed of a heartwood. Its root is impermanent and subject to change. Its trunk is impermanent and subject to change. Its branches and foliage are impermanent and subject to change. And its shadow is impermanent and subject to change. Now, would anyone be speaking rightly who spoke thus? The root, trunk, branches and foliage of this great tree, standing possessed of heartwood, are impermanent and subject to change. But its shadow is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. And they reply, no, as one would, you know, no, Venerable Sir, why is that? Because, Venerable Sir, the root, trunk, branches and foliage of this great tree standing, possessed of heartwood, are impermanent and subject to change. So its shadow must be impermanent and subject to change. And I think most of us would not find that difficult to accept. And then he explains the simile, and we can sort of open it up and just see what people think of the simile. So too, sisters, would anyone be speaking rightly who spoke thus? These six external bases, like the objects of our senses, are impermanent and subject to change. But the pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling, neutral feeling, that one experience is dependent in dependence upon the six external bases is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. And they reply, of course, no, Venerable Sir, why is that? Because each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition, contact, and with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases. And so this is the six external bases, the objects of our experience. And I'd be interested to hear if anybody has any comments about that simile. I always wonder why he uses, like the first one is radiance, isn't it, from the oil lamp burning. And the next one is like the shadow. I wonder why, if there's any significance in putting it that way.
What it is that is so hard to get that perhaps what is ordinary people here see as a matter of fact, what is so hard to get that spiritual?
In that experience? Yeah, I think people would see that very easily, actually. But I think,
you know, what it does is it focuses, doesn't it? It focuses on looking at our experience in more detail, because a lot of the time we just, you know, we don't really look at it. We just experience it, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, and you know, we don't investigate it. So this really focuses the mind in the right area, so that when the mind has enough power, enough peace, enough stability in the mind, the right occasion, then it will see deeply. Then it will see this, not like a, you know, they call this like a catechism, don't they, where you go through these categories, which sounds very dry. Then they'll know it for themselves. Because when you read the verses of the enlightened monks and nuns, sometimes they experience their enlightenment experiences not sitting on the cushion. You know, it may be seeing water running down down a little slope, like Patachara, Bhikkhuni Patachara, I think it was. No, she saw the lamp actually going out. She saw a lamp going out, and that was enough for her to become enlightened. So what happens, I think, is that everything comes together, all this knowledge, this understanding, intellectual work comes together and then is experienced. You know, they see impermanence, really see it, experience it. Because, you know, we have ideas of impermanence, but when real insight comes, it will be totally different from what we expect. And it will really be fresh, alive, and totally vivid. It won't be like reading an account like this, you know. But these things, they get us in the right area, you know, they focus us in the right area. So it's quite helpful. I wondered whether, you know, the shadow might be because they're external things, and really what is lighting up those things, what's actually creating the shadow is the internal sense organs, and the mind is actually illuminating them. A bit like maybe like a movie projector, you know, illuminating, giving us an image. But the light is actually coming in from inside, not from outside. And those things, therefore, are like casting a, you know, that light creates a shadow. It's an idea, anyway. I always wonder, because I think, you know, one, radiance, and then why this shadow, you know? So it's quite. And I think these things, it's good to have these things that catch the mind, because then the mind goes back to them, you know, and keeps, I wonder, why is that so? A bit like a koan, you know, these Japanese puzzles that spiritual teachers give. So the student goes virtually crazy trying to work it out because they're utterly impossible. But it gives rise to possibility of enlightenment, to seeing things totally differently. Maybe because the mind's totally exhausted trying to work it out logically, and then it comes to a more intuitive understanding. That's a good point, actually. Yeah, that's a good point. And the shadow, of course, dependent, isn't it, on very much dependent on having light and everything. Otherwise, if it gets very overcast, my shadow, it's gone. No, that's a good point. So he continues continues the teaching, and he's very pleased again. Good, good sisters. So it is with a noble disciple, maybe an enlightened one, who sees this as it actually is with proper wisdom. And then he gives a very good simile. Sisters, suppose a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to kill a cow and carve it up with a sharp butcher's knife. Without damaging the inner mass of flesh and without damaging the outer hide, he would cut, sever and carve away the inner tendons, sinews and ligaments with the sharp butcher's knife. Then, having cut, severed and carved all this away, he would remove the outer hide and cover the cow again with the same hide. Would he be speaking rightly if he were to say, this cow is joined to this hide just as it was before? No, Venerable Sir, why is that? Because if that skilled butcher or his apprentice were to kill a cow and cut,
sever and carve all that away, even though he covers the cow again that same with that same hide and says, this cow is joined to this hide just as it was before, that cow would still be disjoined from that hide. And then he explains that simile. Sisters, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The inner mass of flesh is a term for the six internal bases. The outer hide is a term for the six external bases. The inner tendons, sinews and ligaments, which have been cut away, is a term for delight and lust. So like tanha and raga, they say in Pali, craving and delight. The sharp butcher's knife is a term for noble wisdom, the noble wisdom that cuts, severs and carves away the inner defilements, the fetters and bonds. So they're the things that are preventing one from becoming enlightened. So the bridge, as it were, between the one of the important bridges for someone who's not enlightened, between the outer and the inner world, is desire and lust, as it's called here, this craving, has been removed. So this person is like an arahant. So they are still experiencing, they still have the sense organs, don't they? An arahant, while they are alive, still have sense organs. The world is still out there of sight, smells, tastes and touches, but that craving that often that unenlightened beings have that goes out and attaches to those objects outside, attaches to even the sense objects, the sense organs, no longer there. So the experience of the world, quite different, but still, you know, the arahant, like the Buddha too, has feeling, don't they? So they have contact with the world. They still experience contact with the world. They hear things, smell things, taste things. And those contacts can either be pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. And so there can be pain or pleasure with them. But with an arahant, they usually say, this relates only to the body. With the mind, with the mental experiences, there's no suffering from like tanha or anything like that. So for them, free, the way they relate to the world, they're free of craving. And so the world, totally a different place, not enslaved. So any comments or questions? I know Ayakima used to she used to, well, it's like a meditation too, which sometimes we encourage us to think of the world from the point of view of an arahant, someone without craving and desire, either for or to get rid of things. So you have this wanting and wanting to get rid of. And I think it's quite an interesting thing to contemplate, because the world would be totally different. It would be mostly, once we have a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant or neutral, there's either liking or disliking, and from that you tend to get this craving to do something about it, you know, either wanting it, think it's good, get it, or wanting to get rid of it. And then after that we have this upadana arising, don't we? Working out ways to actually achieve that, to achieve our desires. But for an arahant, that's not the case. You know, it finishes. There's feeling, pleasant, unpleasant and neutral, but no craving, no craving. Don't have to be... I mean, it's really nice not having to react, as it were, to being free, you know, just things are just as they are. Some people actually, I think, they sometimes think, oh, you know, wouldn't that be boring? Or wouldn't that be as totally, you know, like tasteless or, you know, insipid way of experiencing the world? But actually I think it would be a much more vivid and alive way, because you're not trying to get something out of your experience in the external world. You're not depending on it. You can really be there, you know, and you're not caught, you're not enslaved by it, not having to work out how you're going to get what you've got a craving for, desire for. So I think, you know, it's quite an interesting way to
a contemplation, actually, just to think of the world from the point of view of an enlightened person. And then you realize it's quite a different world from what we inhabit. So it's quite useful, actually. And the sharp butcher's knife is noble wisdom, yes, that it cuts away, severs the inner defilements, so they're like lobha, greed, dosa, hatred, and moha, and all the different shades of those defilements, they're the root defilements. And the fetters, these are the fetters that, 10 fetters that keep us attached to samsara. And bound up to samsara. And so they are cut away by this noble wisdom. And then Brahmanandika continues with his teaching and he says, sisters, there are these 7 enlightenment factors through the development and cultivation of which a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. And the footnote here says that Vimalanandika has brought this in because wisdom is doesn't operate on its own. It's supported by these other factors, which we call enlightenment factors. So they lead to enlightenment. That's why he's bringing it in. And he says that the commentary says that in the wisdom factor is like the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, that quality of mind that can look at what one's experiencing and see the wholesomeness, the unwholesomeness of it, and can investigate it. So we continue with the enlightenment factors. What are the 7? Here, sisters, a bhikkhu develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, sati, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. And these terms are always important for developing enlightenment. So seclusion, viveka, and dispassion, viraga. And so it's like a process of becoming secluded from the defilements temporarily through meditation, through jhana. And dispassion is like the not being caught up with desire and craving, and cessation usually like the cessation of craving, and ripens in relinquishment, letting go happens. But this is sort of letting go that is leading to enlightenment. So. And then he develops the investigation of states enlightenment factor. This is the wisdom element of it. And the energy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the concentration enlightenment factor, the equanimity enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation and ripens in relinquishment. These are the 7 enlightenment factors through the development and cultivation of which a bhikkhu, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. And with these 7 enlightenment factors, can be viewed as like stages almost in meditation. Because this is very much like the stages of meditation, that you develop mindfulness to begin with and you investigate the states that you're experiencing, particularly unwholesome, wholesome, and abandon the unwholesome, so the mind becomes quite pure and then can go into deep meditation. And from when the mind, when you've removed like the impurities, the defilements temporarily from the mind, then one gets energy, the wirya. There's interest and there's energy. It's not going. The energy's not going into the defilements. And then rapture, this delight comes up. And then from rapture, then the body and the mind become tranquil. They could say pasadi. And then concentration, samadhi, arises. The mind becomes one-pointed.
usually in the tranquility factor too, there is an element of happiness as well. Happiness that's because, you know, when there is tranquility and happiness, you're happy to be here wherever you are. You're happy with the moment. And so the mind can just stay in a very small area. When the mind's not happy, discontent, it'll start to go here, there and everywhere looking for happiness. But in this case, it's happy just to be that particular moment, that particular object, the breath, whatever one is using, the feeling of a metta can be. And so then concentration can arise. And when concentration arises, then the equanimity factor of enlightenment arises. And this is when the mind is completely balanced and poised, and that's where it's ready to see things as they truly are. Because it's got no... Because while the mind has got vested interests in what it likes, dislikes, we can't see things clearly at all, because we've already got our agenda, as it were. So we know what we like, what we dislike. But when the mind has reached this equanimity, you can just look and just see how things really are, and then really penetrate and become enlightened. But we need that equanimity, that evenness of mind to go deeply and to see things that maybe you normally wouldn't like. But once we have that balance in the mind, we can see and we can go deeply into it. Does this equanimity here refer to the fourth jhana? I don't think here it does, actually, because my understanding is that would come under concentration more, you know, a level of samadhi, actually. But that may not be correct, but that's what I would think. But in fourth jhana, of course, you know, that equanimity is a very prominent feature. And you notice in the descriptions of when the Buddha becomes enlightened, it's always from fourth jhana. So you may well be right that it refers to fourth jhana too, but the equanimity aspect of it. That because usually we say, don't we, that you can't contemplate in jhana because the mind is so still, so focused in one area, so powerful, that there's no room for, you know, say, contemplating anicca, dukkha, anatta. There's no room for the mind to see more broadly, to get a perspective. So generally, we'd say, come out of that fourth jhana, and then, say, for instance, the Buddha saw his past lives, and then saw beings arising, passing away due to karma, and then went on to understand the Four Noble Truths. So he would have to. It would have to be a sort of equanimity that came from that fourth jhana, was still there in the mind, and so the mind could see deeply. But have to be wider than jhana, because can't get enough perspective. And then, when the venerable Nandika had advised the bhikkhunis thus, he dismissed them, saying, "Go, sisters, it is time." Then the bhikkhunis, having delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Nandika's words, rose from their seats and, after paying homage to the venerable Nandika, departed, keeping him on their right, which is the common way to show respect. They went to the Blessed One. And it's interesting because they're in the city, so they must have come to the Jetavana to see the Buddha. So it's not like they were in the same monastery. They went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, stood at one side. The Blessed One told them, "Go, sisters, it is time." Then the bhikkhunis paid homage to the Blessed One and departed, keeping him on their right. So they just came to affirm that they'd had a teaching and obviously were pleased. But then the Buddha said, soon after they left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. "Bhikkhus, just as on the apposita day of the 14th, people are not doubtful or perplexed as to whether the moon is incomplete or full, since the moon is clearly incomplete, so too those bhikkhunis are satisfied with Nandika's teaching of the Dhamma, but their intention has not yet been fulfilled. So the simile, the moon on the 14th, usually the full moon is a 15th day, isn't it? You know, it's, it occurs, they have these fortnightly cycles. 15 days is the full moon, happens on the full moon. So what the Buddha is saying is, when it's the 14th day, i.e. the day before the full moon, you look up and you think, oh no, there is a little bit missing still. You can see that quite easily. That's what he's saying. And so you know that, you know, the moon, not full yet, not full. And just so he's saying, these bhikkhunis are very satisfied and happy with their teaching, but their intention, and here the commentaries usually say their intention to become enlightened hasn't been fulfilled. You know, they might, it says they have intentions to become a Sotapanna or a Sakadagami, a once returner, an Anagami, a non-returner, or an Arahant. So they have these intentions, but they haven't realised them, they haven't become enlightened. So then the Buddha continues. Anybody have any comments? I'm sorry? Mm-hmm. Oh, right. In the commentary, they're saying to specific types of enlightenment, you know, like Sotapanna and so on. But I think actually, you know, it could be more generally interpreted. You know, they might have had intentions to develop their samadhi, their meditation. They might have intentions to develop more wisdom. So there could be not just intentions to achieve stages of enlightenment, but other intentions too. But, you know, these bhikkhunis, they already had quite a level of wisdom. So it does suggest, doesn't it, that they are ready for a breakthrough, you know, to really see things as they truly are, not just go through the formulas. Yeah, they do, yeah, they do. So I think once they have those sorts of insights, it's just like they're waiting for the match. It's like the powder, you know, the gunpowder waiting for the match, and it will sort of poof, it'll blow up. Or like turning the switch on, it'll happen. The light will come on. So their intention has not been fulfilled. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Nandaka. This is sort of rubbing it in, isn't it, after he was unwilling to go first time. Maybe it was. Well then, Nandaka, tomorrow you should advise the bhikkhunis in exactly the same way. Interestingly, I didn't have time to listen to it, but Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi says that in the Chinese agamas, it doesn't say exactly in the same way. So he may have given this the teaching that he gave here and then gave another teaching. And that's an interesting point because, you know, why would it have to be exactly the same? You know, that was a... There's some interesting things that come out of looking at the Chinese version, so the Majjhima Nikaya, the argument. And he came out with some interesting points, actually, but I didn't have time to check them. So he sends Venerable Nandaka to do it again, exactly the same way. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Nandaka replied. Then the next morning, the Venerable Nandaka dressed and went to the bhikkhunis, and he gave the teaching the same, and then the bhikkhunis paid homage. Then the bhikkhunis were happy, pleased, and then they came and paid respects to the Buddha. And then the bhikkhunis paid homage to the Blessed One and departed, keeping him on their right. And then the Buddha comments. Soon after they left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, just as on the opposite day of the 15th, people are not doubtful or perplexed as to whether the moon is incomplete or full, since the moon is clearly full, so too those bhikkhunis are satisfied with Nandika's teaching of the Dhamma, as they were before, and their intention has been fulfilled. And then he says, bhikkhus, even the least advanced of those 500 bhikkhunis is a stream entra, no longer subject to perdition, bound for delivery, headed for enlightenment. So that's pretty amazing teaching that he managed to. And the commentary says, She who was last in regards to good qualities had become a stream enterer. But those whose intentions were to become once returners, non-returners and arahants, each achieved the fulfillment of their intentions. And because of these results, the Buddha named Venerable Nandika the foremost bhikkhu in instructing the bhikkhunis. And then it concludes with, that is what the Blessed One said, the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Evidently, the Chinese version has a little bit different, evidently. I think they all became arahants, something like that. It's slightly different, actually. But whatever, I mean, they obviously became enlightened. That's the important thing. So Venerable Nandika's teaching had the desired effect, and the desired effect, and because of that, became known as the foremost in teaching the bhikkhunis. So I think that's a nice sutta to do when we consider this. I consider this like full moon to be the nuns, the bhikkhunis' full moon, as it were, especially in Sri Lanka. So does anybody have any questions, comments about this sutta, Nandika Uvada Sutta, advice from Nandika? Yes, that's a good question. Because in the Pali, you usually say Bhagini, don't they? Bhagini sisters, you know. Particularly if a monk is senior, he will, for instance, address other bhikkhus as friend. That was the custom in that time, avuso. But maybe this is like a similar convention that if you're more senior, you call them sisters, yeah. I'm not sure why.
It's also the translation.
Yeah, that's true. But also another thing you have in Asia, in particular, I sit in Sri Lanka, there's often like kinship terms are used a lot for people who are not related to you. So, you know, people call somebody auntie or uncle, not related at all, you know. And even in Sri Lanka, they have, it's quite nice actually in some ways, if a friend goes and visits his friend and his mother's there, you'll call that woman mother too. You know, so it may be like a cultural difference actually, using different terms. Yeah. Yes. But as you say, Lynn, it could be translation. You know, there may be other terms you could use. But I think kinship terms are often used. So. Yes. Yes. No, it is. And that sequence particularly is. And the only way one can become really, truly dispassionate is through understanding and wisdom. Not to be cold and not to be indifferent. It's sort of a wisdom that knows, you know, these things happen and they cause a lot of suffering and hardship for people. But at the same time, wisdom, as Ayakema would say, allows one not to become a sufferer too. Because if one person is suffering and another person starts suffering with them, now we've got two people suffering. But if we have wisdom, we can not suffer and be of some help to that person. Not cold or indifferent, that's no use, you know. But to really help them. Because I don't know about you, if you get too caught up in empathising, sometimes it sort of cripples your faculty to be able to use your intelligence well, so you can actually help in some very appropriate way, you know, and can be very useful. But that dispassion, I think, too, comes from seclusion, is like the dispassion that comes from meditation, when you come out of deep meditation, and then one's not caught up with desires and wanting and trying to get rid of things. There's dispassion in the mind, but more looking on. So the mind's not totally engaged, not totally taken up with experience. You know, so it's it's a very, very useful quality we need, actually, if we're going to see things differently. So, yes. So... Oh, was it? Ah. Total eclipse last night. Ah. So you could see the moon covered completely, yeah. No, it's quite... Ah.
Watching it rising, awful.
Yeah. Ah. Oh, really? That's in... I heard something... I saw something that the moon was orange or something.
Yes. That's...
Yeah, yeah, because of this eclipse, I saw something. Dark, amazing, yeah. There's something special about eclipses, aren't there? And whether the sun particularly, it's very eerie, but we don't notice the moon quite as much, but yeah, it is. Yes. So maybe we can finish this, pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and if anybody has anything they'd like to discuss, please come up.